Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the challenges facing the city of Detroit's revival through the eyes of a couple who decided to take a leap of faith in the city's renewal and purchase an abandoned home. In 2013, just months before Detroit declared bankruptcy, Amy and Carl Heimerl bought a 3,000-square-foot 1914 Georgian revival home in Detroit's West Village neighborhood. They paid $35,000 for it, cash, as no bank would lend money. In fact, nearly 90% of Detroit's homes, even today, are still purchased without a mortgage. Banks won't lend the money because, in this case, the house had no plumbing, no electricity, windows, or heat. But it did have history and potential. Amy relates their story on investing their lives in a city that most have given up on in her book, Detroit Hustle, a memoir of love, life, and home. In it, she relates how neighbors came to them teary-eyed, grateful they'd taken a chance on Detroit, while others, Detroit haters, she calls them, urged them to get out while they still could. Amy Heimerl is an adjunct professor at Michigan State University and a freelance journalist who writes about entrepreneurship and economic development. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Amy Heimerl, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Your book, Detroit Hustle, depicts you're moving to Detroit at a point when Detroit was nearly at its lowest. I think you bought a house in the West Village, a 3,000-square-foot abandoned Georgian Revival 1914 house that you bought in cash for $35,000, I think, what was it, about a couple of months before Detroit declared bankruptcy?
6 weeks, yeah. We decided to buy and invest our lives in Detroit, and then 6 weeks later, the city declared bankruptcy.
So what went into the decision to move to Detroit? You relate that most of your life, you have been a person that has rehabbed old properties due to necessity more than anything else, but you and your husband, Carl, decided to settle in Detroit. What led to that?
So initially, you know, we were living in New York in the Red Hook, Brooklyn neighborhood, which had sort of historically been disadvantaged. There wasn't public transportation, but it was this great community spirit that really drew us, and we loved it. But being there, we were starting to feel priced out. And when we thought about sort of a middle-class, you know, couple not being able to afford to buy a place there, we thought, well, where would we go? We thought about a lot of other cities, but we weren't really feeling places like Seattle or Portland that are lovely, but maybe felt too much like they already had an established identity. We were thinking about some place we could go and that had a real community sense, like Red Hook. And I will be honest, I didn't think Detroit would be the place at first. It was really my husband who fell for it. I got a fellowship at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. So for a year, we were in Ann Arbor and getting to know Detroit. And during that getting to know process, I fell in love with the people of the city, I would say, before I fell in love with the city itself and decided to make it home.
Now, at one point after your fellowship, you had a choice of, you had two job offers, one in Detroit and one in Oakland. And Oakland is sort of, another city that sort of is the subject of jokes every once in a while, like Detroit is, sort of a down-on-its-luck city. And you visited both, didn't you?
We did. Apparently, I have a thing for down-on-its-luck cities. I'm from Denver before Denver is what it is now, back when everybody joked that we just, you know, we must ride horses on our wooden sidewalks. But looking at both Detroit and Oakland, I was initially really feeling Oakland, you know, more sunshine, good tacos. I really liked the sort of racial diversity there that, you know, was sort of no majority, and I thought that would be an interesting place to live. But when we got there, my husband was still really feeling Detroit, and I was outside smoking, and my mother is so pleased to know I've since quit smoking. And these guys kind of came up to me, and they weren't being aggressive, but they were like, hey, don't you know it's not safe out here? And my first reaction to them was, I'm from Detroit. And I thought, oh my goodness, if I'm calling on the street cred of a city I don't even live in yet, something's telling me that's supposed to be home.
Of course, what was the reaction, though? The reaction was even better.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you got this. Like, oh, wow, what's it like there? And I was like, it's fantastic. And this was in 2012, and it's not that the city wasn't, you know, deeply mired in both financial and social problems, poverty, things like that. But this community spirit, you know, in a place where there's a common enemy, which here is just the struggle, everybody's really pulling together and makes this beautiful community. And that's sort of what I meant in the book by it being fabulous, is that the community in Detroit was really fabulous.
But your first reaction to Detroit, once your husband said, I'd like to move to Detroit, I want to buy a home, and I want to try to do it in Detroit. Your first reaction when you actually began to look at, you know, how you would buy a house, it wasn't all that positive, was it? What was your first reaction?
My first reaction was, what have we done? Oh my goodness, what are we thinking about? And part of it is, when you go to a new city, you don't know what you don't know. So you don't know how it ebbs and flows. You don't know the highway system or the back roads yet. You can't put yourself in place or time or anything. So we came into town that first visit to Detroit looking for a piano. Because when we came for the fellowship, one of the deals was my husband would be able to, you know, practice piano and take classes at the University of Michigan. So we were looking for that piano. And there was one we'd been looking forever, and we finally found one that was supposed to be in Detroit. So we go looking for this piano shop, and we have no idea where we are. But it's like the middle of summer. It's hot. The sun's beating down. This is a city that was designed for the car. So it's not big, gracious boulevards with canopied trees. It's just mile after mile, it feels like, of broken concrete and asphalt and blight and devastation. And I thought, oh my gosh, we can't move here. This isn't, where is all of the energy that we're hearing about? Where's all the new buildings and the opportunity and sort of the narrative that had been out nationally, which was Detroit was a comeback city. And that was even before the bankruptcy. You know, right. Patti Smith had told people, like, New York is dead, go to Detroit. And that was a shock. And it took me a while to get beyond that and start to see that Detroit's 139 square miles. And some of them are devastated, and some of them are coming back. It's all Detroit, and we are learning to love all of it. That first impression was a tough one.
Yeah. Eventually, on a further trip, you began to find some things. You said, this is it, like the market.
Yeah. So as we started coming down more frequently, thankfully, my husband was the one who really said, no, let's stick with this. And we started finding the Guardian building, which was built in the 20s, that, I mean, the money and the wealth, like I take everybody in this building from no matter where they are in the world, they walk into this building and they've never seen anything like it. Terracotta tiles, the sort of Aztec architecture, it's stunning. The riverfront, nobody expects like there to be this amazing riverfront esplanade, you know, in Detroit, you know, or Belle Isle. And sort of like, I go to Belle Isle, which is a 900-acre island park in the middle of the Detroit River. I go there every day, and I can just sort of walk through the woods, and I'm seeing herons and songbirds, and it's peaceful. Or I can go downtown, and there's restaurants. So it started to feel like, okay, I can see that there is more to Detroit, but it is also the complication that says things are happening in downtown and midtown, sort of that heart of the city. But further out, making sure, what are we doing about the blight and devastation and the people who are having to live in that and creating opportunity across the city?
Of course, once you got serious about finding a home, you found that this is one of the big barriers to home ownership in Detroit. It's difficult to buy a home.
It is. So, you know, you hear about the $1,000 house or the $5,000 house in Detroit. And as we've learned, there's a reason why it's $1,000 in Detroit.
It's not livable.
Not livable. It's not like you get a house for $1,000 that has everything you need. And so when you go to buy it, the bank is like, no. That's a terrible plan. You know, they don't know how to finance things that are that cheap. You know, they're just not interested in writing mortgages on $30,000 houses. But more than that, they're like, how do we write a mortgage on a house that has no plumbing, no electrical, no heating, no windows, like ours did? So it's a real conundrum. So much interest in the city and coming to the city and rehabbing these properties, but very difficult to get the financing. Things are changing. The Detroit Land Bank has been auctioning off homes and trying to get beyond some of the problems, but it's still a challenge in the market.
Now, when you bought your home in 2013, only 10% of the homes in Detroit were bought with a mortgage. That is an astounding statistic.
And that's still true.
It's still true today.
It's still true today. And part of it is, it's, you know, people assume it's because of creditworthiness. And, you know, reporting from Zillow says, no, creditworthiness is only responsible for killing about 20% of deals. The bulk of it is appraisal problems, because the banks say, all right, you want to buy this house for $100,000. You and the seller have agreed. That's awesome. We're willing to write the mortgage. I mean, this is a house that we're talking move-in ready that doesn't have any real problems. But then the appraiser comes in and says, well, this house is only worth $75,000. you've got that problem on houses that are move-in ready. Now you take ones that's the majority of the housing stock that need significant amount of work, and the banks say, I'm sorry, you'd like us to give you $100,000 for a house that will be worth less than that when it's finished? And you can see the conundrum. The banks aren't being stingy necessarily. It doesn't make economic sense. At the same time, how do you rebuild a city like Detroit that for many reasons has been allowed to decay so far that it fundamentally costs the same to rehab a house in Detroit as it does in Tulsa, as it does in Atlanta, you know? So that causes a problem. If it costs the same here as anywhere else, but housing prices are so low here, how do you bridge that gap? And that's what we're trying to figure out as a city right now.
Now, the house you picked was a 3,000-square-foot 1914 Georgian Revival, abandoned home, had no plumbing, no electricity, no heat, and you bought it for cash for $35,000. And I assume no bank would touch that, even though this was in a it's in the West Village. It's very close to Indian Village, which is a very nice neighborhood in Detroit. And you had some neighbors. I assume it was a neighborhood where there would be some houses that were kept up along with quite a few abandoned houses, right?
So, yeah, so the neighborhood was great. I mean, there were some abandoned houses, but not like you maybe imagine when you see pictures of Detroit. This was sort of a stable neighborhood where most houses were occupied. I'd say maybe 15% weren't. And those that were, you know, the remainder were in various states of maintenance. Some people were able to do better upkeep. Others were struggling, you know. So, but a strong neighborhood. It's been on the National Register of Historic Places since 1980. So people care. But the banks, you know, A, $35,000 was really too low for a mortgage, but construction, again, at that time in early 2013, this was pre-bankruptcy. People weren't saying this is a good opportunity. You didn't have New York and Chinese investors coming in and, you know, rehabbing commercial buildings. It was a very different time, and, the banks wouldn't touch it. They were like, we can't do a construction loan. We can't do anything. They said, the best we can offer you. One local bank said, if you can come up with the cash to rehab the house, you can come to us afterward. Hopefully it will, you know, we'll do the appraisal and we will give you the money for the that you've spent to be able to pay off contractors or, you know, however you've had to do the work and repay yourself. So that's what we did. We had to come up with all of the cash.
Yeah. And the decision to buy was based on a couple of factors. One was right in front of the house was one of the one working street lights in the neighborhood, and a neighbor named Jim Doyle, who came up to you immediately and said, hey, you thinking about living here? You can do it.
Yeah. I mean, the neighbors here are the selling point. This is an amazing neighborhood, and we love this house. We felt, you know, my husband says he knew this was the one in the same way he knew I was the one. So we felt it, but the neighbors are what sealed the deal. So Jim comes across, and he's saying, you can do this. This is going to be great. The next day, we're getting emails and phone calls from other neighbors telling us, oh, my gosh, please do it. And can we tell you the history of this house? You know, Arthur Herzog used to live there, and he wrote for Billie Holiday. And let us tell you about the fabulous historical parties that used to be in it. And it was just like we'd been immediately brought into this cocoon. And so we knew that this was, A, the house, but more importantly, B, the neighborhood to make our lives in.
You nicknamed your house Matilda, but pretty soon you learned that in the neighborhood it was known as Nona's Place. That was Arthur Herzog's wife, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, and Arthur Herzog was a songwriter, worked as a, I think he was like a jobber in New York, working a song, doing songwriting and doing publicity for movies, and eventually settled in Detroit.
He did. So, yeah, he, you know, was, I believe that like sort of 1930s and, you know, came from wealth in New York, but saw the, at that time, Detroit was bustling. It was the center of opportunity. And so he came here and he stayed the rest of his life. He married Nona Herzog, you know, Nona, and they lived in this house. And, you know, he continued to have, like, I guess Nina Simone had dinner here. And just he used to throw these dinner parties and he would type up the menu on his script typewriter and the guest list. And there are all these bound volumes at one of his family members' houses out on Long Island, and they've offered to let me come and see them.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, it's pretty amazing. The history in this house is really amazing.
But the history, once you bought this house, was hard to see. This house had great bones, but I assume that people had looted the plumbing, looted the electrical wire, or had it just been stolen, or had just been salvaged in some way?
So most of it had been taken out, you know, plumbing, copper being stolen, all of that. But yeah, it didn't have anything left in it. There was very little of historical relevance. The few things that we got were these amazing ribbon oak floors. So our floors are just the real thin oak strips, and they're gorgeous, and we were able to save those. We had to patch in a couple places, but that was there. Some tile, hexagonal tile in the bathroom, a couple of doors, but beyond that, everything was pretty much gone, which is unfortunate. So the thing I have learned is that if you're ever buying a historic house and you're renovating it and it has, say, doors you don't like, just take them off the hinges and store them in the basement for the future. It's really expensive to have to go and buy, like we did, 27 new interior doors. It's a lot cheaper to be able to just replace them as you prefer.
Now, you mentioned the neighborhood is in the National Register of Historic Places. Does that make it more difficult to do the renovation? Because I know just one of the early decisions was that it was water or windows, because most of the windows were knocked out. And I assume these 1914 Georgian Revival would have sort of studio glass, or maybe, you know, arts and crafts sort of looking windows or something like that.
They had what's called 6-over-1, so it's a solid lower panel window with then the six smaller panels above it on each of the windows. And so, yes, it does. It's not about the National Register, but it's about the fact that we are a historic neighborhood in Detroit, and so Detroit's Historic Commission oversees all of its historic neighborhoods. And, yeah, so if you buy in a historic neighborhood, it's going to raise the prices, because you have to, you know, do your construction in a way that honors, you know, the historical nature of the house. So, thankfully, they allowed us, there was a local window manufacturer, Kelly Windows, that does sort of a modern version of the historic window that's got, you know, double panes and is more energy efficient, and they allowed us to do that. But it wasn't just go buy vinyl windows from Home Depot and throw them in, you know, and I appreciate that. It's, you know, I believe that we're stewards of the history of this neighborhood and stewards of the history of this house. And we knew going in that that was going to be a little bit more expensive in the rehab, but what we get then is this sort of intact neighborhood. So, it's the trade-off.
My guest today is Amy Heimerl, adjunct professor at Michigan State University, a freelance journalist on entrepreneurship and economic development, and she's the author of a memoir which tells not only her life story, but also the story of buying this 1914 Georgian Revival in Detroit's West Village neighborhood, known as Nona's Place. The name of the book is Detroit Hustle, a memoir of love, life, and home. It's published by Running Press. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, once you began renovation and rehab, I was struck by one of your father's words, or your stepfather's words, that the bitterness of poor quality and workmanship remains long after the sweetness of the low bid. I'm going to remember that for life. That's a great saying. But one of the difficulties you had was finding a contractor that wanted to work in Detroit.
We did. I never expected that. But, you know, as we realized that this project was way too big for us to be able to DIY it, which was our original intention, despite the fact that my husband is not handy and, you know, my parents are embarrassed that I have so little skills this way, since my dad was an excavator. There's nothing my mother can't do without a trip to the library. You know, if we were trying to do something small, like fix up a room, we could have done it. But this was too big. So we looked for contractors. And either people just did not want to come work in the city of Detroit. There was a history of, you know, contractors getting their tools stolen while they're on the job site or getting mugged. You know, Detroit has a history of crime and people feeling unsafe. Thankfully, we've not experienced that for the most part. But then even when we could get people to come and look at it, they thought we were crazy for investing in Detroit. So we wound up with one contractor, Calvin and Christian Garfield with Maxwell Construction. And this story in the book is, you know, in many ways it's a love story between us and Detroit. And it's also a love story of, like, our contractors. We are so blessed to have them.
That's such a rare story.
Yes, exactly.
That makes this book unusual on many levels.
Well, and it also made it hard to write, because when I was thinking about doing the book, A, we thought we'd be doing it ourselves, or B, you know, you assume it'll be like a money pit or Under the Tuscan Sun, and there will be contractor troubles that will create conflict. And as we're going through it and there's no conflict, I'm like, oh, my goodness, what am I going to do? There's nothing to write about.
Well, the obstacles just to Detroit, and you mentioned you settled on Cal, but the first contractor you actually got to come to the home, that was probably your first encounter with what you refer to as Detroit haters.
Yes.
Tell me about Detroit haters.
I mean, Detroit haters, there's sort of two breeds of them. One is sort of, there's a lot of tension here in the city between the city and the suburbs. You know, a lot of people who live in the suburbs, their families at some point in time left the city, felt like they had to leave for safety reasons, education reasons, all the same reasons across the country that we experienced white flight in the 1960s and 70s, and then continued sort of middle class flight out in the 80s and 90s. You know, it's just really, really complicated. And so a lot of people just feel a lot of hate towards Detroit, that it's just, you know, it's just a cesspool. You know, it just needs to be written off. It's too dangerous. It's, you know, it's corrupt. It's all of these things, which some are true and some are not. And so there's that breed of sort of Detroit hater, and this contractor was one of them. He was just somebody who was like, the city is a terrible place. And then there's sort of the internal living in the city Detroit hater who can kind of hate everything new and changing about the city. And that sort of when people are coming back after, you know, coming back into the city and wanting to live here now, maybe the grandchildren or great-grandchildren of people who left, there's a frustration and a feeling of like, well, don't let the screen door, you know, hit your butt on the way out. Like, why are you coming back and telling us what the city's supposed to be like now? We stayed and stuck it out. And so you can get it both ways, and both have a lot of truth and a lot of reasons behind why they feel that. And I think it's one of the complicated things of the city in this region as we figure out what the future of the city is going to be. How do we fight 40% poverty? How do we fix education? How do we get public transportation? We can't do it with division. We can only do it unified, and a lot of that healing has to happen right now. But the haters certainly make that a struggle.
You wrote, a column on the process of rehabbing this home pretty early in the process, and I think there was it an email or a telephone message in which you sort of really encountered that latter group where, you know, he lived there. This person had lived there his whole life. He just felt betrayed by the city in many ways.
He did. And I got it was an anonymous voicemail left on my work phone, and he was basically saying, "Get out now. You're going to leave just like everybody else has. When, you know, I've had to stay. Don't make my mistakes." And so he sort of hates the city. And then the one I didn't talk about in the book was, you know, I also got some comments from, again, somebody being anonymous when I wrote about the house and what we were doing. And the comment was, "You're raping Detroit."
Really?
And that was really both powerful and hurtful. And I didn't quite know how to react, because in the sort of context that we talk about with gentrification, people feeling displaced, Detroit's an interesting conversation because things are changing rapidly right now, which is scaring people. But we still have a per capita income of less than $25,000, which is not much. And this house that we are doing, nobody was displaced. We took something that was completely empty and brought it back to life, which is the story of so much of the city. And at the same time, who's able to do that because of the real estate situation where you can't get mortgages? Who's able to do that affects what the culture of the city is going forward. So even though that statement, "You're raping Detroit," is really bitter and difficult, I also had to look at that and think, what was the intention and the thought behind that, and try to make my peace with it.
Is the thought that if a neighborhood gentrifies and I'm making that median income, I'm priced out of my house?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of, so the West Village, we can talk about it specifically now. So when we moved in, you know, a stable neighborhood, but a lot of people who'd been here many decades, you know, and had been underwater in their houses, not because of anything they had done, but the real estate market crashing prices. So, you know, we could buy a house for $35,000 that was basically abandoned, but that meant all of our neighbors around us who'd been maintaining their houses, you know, their houses still weren't worth that much just because they were in the city of Detroit. And now we're coming in and we're raising prices, so that's good for them, right? So our house, you know, sort of elevates their property value. So now people can't, you know, say our neighbors can sell if they want to. We've got elderly neighbors who are thinking like, well, maybe we need to go into more of a condo situation where we have less yard to take care of, or we need to send kids to college, or we need to put our mother in assisted living, and now we can sell our house and actually make a little bit of a profit to do that, because that's how most Americans acquire wealth is through real estate.
Right.
But now that they're selling it at those higher level prices, can locals afford to buy it? Or is it just people like my husband and I, or newcomers coming in who are used to higher prices anywhere else? So this feels really cheap to them, even though it feels really expensive to people who live here. It happened to me in Denver all the time. People would come in from California, Texas, New York, even my best friend, and see the home prices in Denver in the early 2000s and be like, oh my God, this is crazy. I can have an amazing house for just $200,000. Ridiculous. And I was like, right, but for those of us who are from here, we can't afford these prices anymore because the salaries don't match. So you create a situation where only new income and newcomers can afford it, and that starts creating conflict.
And how big is this tension today towards the revitalization of Detroit? You mentioned earlier, you know, Chinese buyers buying commercial buildings and people from the East Coast. It's got to be causing some resentment.
The tensions are high right now. They're very high. I think it's caused by a couple things. One is sort of a lot of money is flowing into downtown and midtown. And part of that is 30 years of building blocks of people trying to get this to happen and recessions getting in the way. So you're seeing a lot of what had been sowed finally being reaped. In the meantime, you can go just 3 miles outside of that area, and it's still devastation. But we're getting, streetlights are getting turned back on. Part of the advantage of the bankruptcy was we now have the money to invest in city services. Things that probably people in Tulsa take for granted.
No, we don't take streetlights for granted here.
Oh, don't you? That's okay. I'm always assumed that everybody else has their streetlights.
Right.
Half of ours didn't work. We now are getting them turned back on. We're getting trash pickup. Things that are just basic city services that a lot of places don't think about. And now for us, it's that low-hanging fruit is actually happening. But with that, it says, again, is all of this that's happening, all of these new jobs that are being created and all of these new restaurants that are being opened, this is great, but who are they for? It feels to a lot of people like they're just for my husband and I, or they're just for the new young single professionals who are coming and moving downtown, and that a lot of the rest of the city either don't have access to that because they don't have cars, because car insurance is still the most expensive in the country is in Detroit. Homeowners insurance, still one of the most expensive cities in the country. So all of these challenges and newcomers arriving, and you think about, I talk about this a lot, people from like us from New York. If you're in New York, one of the cultures is to not say hello to each other. There's 8 million of us. You cannot say hi to everybody on the street. It would just be tedious. And because there are so many, what we've created is a culture of being able to create anonymity in really tight spaces. So we just have learned to train ourselves to not see what people are having to do around them because we have to live in tight quarters in public. So that's the culture. That's the graciousness, is to not see, not say hello, allow people some anonymity. But you get to a place like Detroit or cities like New Orleans that
or
are more
Tulsa.
Of a village, more communal.
We say hello.
We say hello, and that's part of the culture. So I think we get that conflict if people come, they don't know how to say hello to their neighbors and think they're being kind by not, because that's the social norm where they're coming from, and not understanding that it's a new social norm here. And so how do we educate and talk about those things, that when you come to a new place, you can't just expect it to be a cheaper version of wherever you've come from. You have to be willing to learn what the norms are and fit into that. And if you don't like them, maybe that's not the place for you to come to.
Yeah. And for a city where the attraction is the neighborhoods and the people, that's got to happen for Detroit to really get out of the funk it's been in.
Absolutely.
Journalist Amy Heimerl is the author of Detroit Hustle, a memoir of love, life, and home. It's published by Running Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.